This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Ira Flatow is away. Later this hour, we'll talk with an archaeologist who's hunting for lost tombs in Viking settlements by scanning satellite photos. And yes, you can do it too. But first, the number of people living with diabetes today is four times higher than it was a generation ago. That's 422 million adults worldwide as of 2014, according to a new report out this week by the World Health Organization. One of the reasons the WHO cites for premature death and complications is the lack of access to affordable insulin. In fact, according to an analysis by my next guest, the price of insulin has tripled in the last decade. We're talking prices of anywhere from even $300 a vial for insulin analogs, and many patients need more than one vial a month. Dr. Bill Herman is a professor of internal medicine and epidemiology at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He published that study on insulin prices in the Journal of the American Medical Association this week. Dr. Herman, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, John.
If you've experienced a price hike in insulin yourself, give us a call. We'd like to hear your story. 844-724-8255. Again, that's 844-SCI-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry. So, Doctor, why are prices going up so much right now?
Well, there have been changes in the available insulin preparations, and prices have gone up with advances in insulin. In the 1920s, Banting and Best discovered insulin, and it was for the next 50 years produced from the pancreases of cows and pigs. In the mid-1970s, it became possible to synthesize human insulin by splicing the human insulin gene into yeast and bacteria. And with that advance, there was an increase in the price of insulin. And then in the mid-1990s, new designer or insulin analogs became available. And with that, there was another increase in the price of insulins.
So this is the part I don't understand. As the need for insulin goes up and new technologies are developed to produce insulin in new ways, how is it that the cost has gone up so much? To what can we attribute this?
Well, it's been a subtle change. Insulin, the animal species insulin into the 1970s were available at about $5 a vial, being 10 milliliters or about 2 teaspoons full of insulin. When the human insulins were introduced, the price went from $5 a vial to $20 a vial. And with the introduction of the insulin analogs in the 1990s, the price went up to about $35 a vial. Since the 1990s, though, the market share has changed, so animal insulins are no longer available, and human insulin now represents only about 10% of the market. So about 90% of Americans are now using the insulin analogs. And with the shift to the use of analog insulins, the prices have increased dramatically for analogs from $35 a vial now to approximately $150 a vial for the short-acting insulin analogs, and pushing $300 a vial for the longer-acting insulin analogs.
Do these insulin analogs work better for patients than the traditional forms that we had years ago?
So there have been incremental benefits with the analogs. The short-acting insulin analogs actually better mimic insulin secretion in response to food. There's a rapid onset and offset of the insulin. And the long-acting insulin analogs provide a basal insulin. They're non-peaking, so they better mimic basal insulin secretion. So yes, there are incremental benefits. They may be associated with less low blood sugar reactions and less weight gain than the older human insulins, but one has to obviously weigh the benefits against the increased costs.
And they don't necessarily work better for all patients, right?
No, the evidence suggests that the analogs are probably preferred for patients with type 1 diabetes, but many patients with type 2 diabetes could probably still be treated as effectively with the human insulins with the same results.
We're talking with Dr. Bill Herman, who's written a paper about the rising price of insulin, even as more people in America and around the world have diabetes and need this treatment. We're taking some of your phone calls at 844-724-8255. Let's go to Jesse, who is calling from Kansas City, Kansas. Hi, Jesse. Go ahead. You're on Science Friday.
Hi. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, what's
on
your mind?
Nice to hear someone talking about diabetes.
Yes, so what's your story? Are you paying more for insulin these days?
I absolutely am. I was diagnosed on April Fool's Day in 2009, so I'm kind of a relatively new diabetic, but I've lived in other countries where healthcare is free, and now I'm recently moved back to America, and I can tell you the last time I went to go pick up my insulin, it cost me $175 after my insurance.
My goodness. And it's gone up how much over time? So you said diagnosed back in 2009 or so, so the price has gone up quite a bit over that time.
Absolutely. I mean, granted, when I was first diagnosed and I was 18, my parents were helping me pay for it. But now I'm in my mid-20s, I'm on my own, and I can definitely see that the bills keep getting higher and I don't really see any solution in sight.
Jesse, thank you so much for sharing your story. So, Bill Herman, this is what I think we might hear from a lot of people. They're having this situation, but Jesse also says, I've lived other places where medicine is free in other countries. You know, it's going to be a lot easier to get cheap insulin than it is here in the U.S.
That is true. There have been 13 price increases since 2009 in the long-acting insulin analogs in the U.S., and the price of the insulin analogs is really very much out of keeping with other both European countries as well as countries around the world. So there is a premium price charged in the U.S. for these insulins.
For many people, insulin is a life-sustaining drug. If they don't get it, they're going to die. Do you expect that some of the price increases that we're seeing could actually be leading to premature death?
Well, we definitely see people cutting back or skipping doses of insulin because they can't afford it. I would hope that that wouldn't happen, but I don't see it as being outside of the realm of possibility.
Why is there no generic insulin available?
Insulin is a protein, and so there cannot be a generic form of insulin. There will be biosimilar insulins, which are the same basic protein structure, but because proteins vary in the way they are manufactured in their biologic activity, it's not possible, and certainly under FDA rules, there are no generic proteins or insulins available.
Is there any way to target new insulin therapies to patients with specific genotypes, more of a type of personalized medicine for diabetics?
So not really at this point. There are lots of alternative treatments to insulin that can be used, probably a dozen different treatments, obviously not for people with type 1 diabetes, but there are certainly alternatives to insulin for people with type 2 diabetes who do not yet require insulin.
I want to go back to the phones here. Sid is calling from Jacksonville, Florida. Hi, Sid.
Hi. I was just going to say, at one point I had my insulin covered by insurance. After a divorce, I no longer had that insurance. I started taking trips down to the Dominican Republic, whereas here I spend about $120 for a bottle of insulin. Down there, I pay $18 for a bottle of insulin, same exact insulin.
And we've heard
priced differently.
Yeah, we've heard, Sid, thank you for that. And we've heard stories, doctor, about patients, of course, going up to Canada for this thing as well. Are you seeing any sort of movement of people trying to find a lower priced drug?
Yes, certainly there is a lot of that going on. One of the other problems with insulin is the issue of list price versus the price available to large pharmacy benefit managers, for instance. Patients without insurance pay the list price. Pharmacy benefit managers who manage pharmacy for large insurance companies can negotiate for rebates with the insulin manufacturers, and so the cost to the pharmacy benefit managers is often substantially less than an individual without insurance who has to go to a local pharmacy to get a bottle of insulin will pay. So there's really a lack of transparency in insulin pricing, which really is an issue of equity. The people least able to afford insulin often end up paying the highest price.
One more quick phone call. Noelle in Hartford, Connecticut. Go ahead, Noelle.
Yes, I am a type 1 diabetic for the last 25 years. And when I was first diagnosed, I paid about $25 to $30 a bottle. and I now have a high deductible plan, and my insulin costs about $400 a bottle.
$400 a bottle. Noelle, thank you for sharing that story. And doctor, we're almost out of time, but what can doctors and patients do about this? Because it seems as though this is going to be a real problem with more and more people developing diabetes in America.
Well, I think we need to call for greater transparency in insulin pricing. And I think it would also help for people and physicians, when possible, to use alternate preparations of insulin for their patients who require insulin, perhaps human insulins rather than the analog insulins for patients with uncomplicated type 2 diabetes.
It seems that treating diabetes would be more cost-effective in the long term in the healthcare system than paying for complications. I mean, it seems as though these prices going up are causing a real problem for our healthcare industry, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's well known that insulin is life-saving for people with type 1 diabetes, and appropriate insulin treatment for anyone with diabetes can prevent blindness, kidney failure, amputations, and cardiovascular disease, reduce mortality, and in fact save costs.
Well, we've run out of time, but Dr. Bill Herman, a professor of internal medicine and epidemiology at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, John.
You can continue to tweet us some of your stories about the high price of insulin at SciFry. Coming up after our break, how satellite photography can pinpoint lost civilizations. And maybe, just maybe, it can help protect them from looting and destruction too. Please stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. You might think of archaeology as a pretty dusty, pretty dangerous trade. At least that's how Indy makes it look. But these days, with satellites canvassing the skies, sporting better and better cameras, modern-day maps to hidden tombs and treasures can be found right on your iPad, if you know where to look. Unfortunately, looters also can use Google Maps to find places to plunder. Not without being watched, though, because all this satellite imagery also turns out to be a great way to track crime, to track illegal digs, destruction of cultural heritage sites, and human rights violations, too. Susan Wolfenbarger is director of the Geospatial Technologies Project at the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Wolfenbarger.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
We're excited to have you. And Sarah Parkak is a National Geographic Fellow and TED Prize winner, professor of anthropology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Parkak.
It's great to be back.
So, Dr. Parkak, I will start with you. One of your latest finds is a possible Viking settlement in Newfoundland, which would make it only the second known settlement in North America. It's pretty cool, right?
Yes, it's early days. We have a lot more work to do before we're able to determine whether or not it is a settlement, but everything is seeming to be very suggestive.
Looking at a regular satellite map of the area in Google Maps, I have to say, I just can't say it looks like there's much there. What are you seeing? What are you looking at that we're not seeing?
So we looked at the entirety of the eastern coastline of Canada, kind of narrowed it down, and picked out a number of promising hotspots. And then for those areas, we got what's known as multispectral satellite imagery. So vegetation grows on top of ancient remains, and the remains buried beneath the ground make the vegetation impossible to see, or the health differences impossible to see in the naked human eye. And we have to process the data using the infrared to make those differences stand out.
Okay, so that's so interesting. So you're essentially just looking at changes in plant life over all this time.
Yes, for this particular site.
My goodness. By the way, if you have any questions for our guest, 844-724-8255, that's 844-SCI-TALK, as we take a look at what we can see from the skies. Susan, you've been using satellite imagery to monitor cultural sites in Syria for about 4 years now. Has the situation there got quite a bit worse under ISIS, or was destruction of some of these archaeological sites already underway?
Well, we've been looking, as you said, for a number of years at the situation in Syria since the civil war began. And really, the destruction that we're seeing has not been just an ISIS phenomenon. That's something I can't say enough times. There was destruction happening across many sites long before ISIS entered the picture. There were encampments of, for example, Assad regime forces on some very well-known sites. We are seeing signs of encampments on some of the tells, which are kind of higher areas. These archaeological sites are elevated above the surrounding landscape, so that makes them very good spots for military encampments. So we've seen a lot of damage happening across the entirety of the Syrian civil war, and it's not just a new phenomenon.
How bad has it gotten from your space-based view at the ancient ruins there at Palmyra, something that we've all been watching from afar?
Well, Palmyra, as you know, was recently taken back by the Assad regime and with the help of the Russian forces. And Palmyra was in control by the Syrian government, and there was some damage that we saw there, as I said before, encampments and things on the site itself. So there was some damage to start with. And then, of course, we're all very aware of all the tragic events that happened on the site while ISIS was in control, the destruction of the Temple of Bel and Bel Shamin, and the destruction of the Arch, and, of course, the tragic beheadings and things that were happening there. And so, you know, there's been quite a bit of damage that's happened at Palmyra over the past few years.
Sarah, over your career, you've also seen evidence of tomb raiding, illegal digs, stuff like the stuff that Susan is talking about. What happens when you see that? Is there any recourse? I mean, what happens next when you see something like this?
So it's interesting what Susan just said, talking about all of the damage and how it just didn't start with ISIL. We've used primarily open source satellite data and looked at looting across the entirety of Egypt at every site going back to 2002. What we found is that the looting didn't really, it didn't get much worse after the Arab Spring. It actually started in 2009 after the economic recession. So what we're doing with all this data, we have evidence for looting at 267 sites, and we're sharing that with the Egyptian government just because they don't have a comprehensive monitoring system. And by giving them that data and showing them exactly where the looting is going on, they can then allocate resources and direct efforts to protect sites on the ground.
It sounds, Susan, like what you're both doing is kind of countering some narratives that we had in the press over what's happening and when.
Yes, definitely. That is one of the great things that we can do with satellite imagery, because it's a very respected type of scientific analysis. It's date stamped, it's location specific, and so we've used that in a number of different ways to counter propaganda that's going on. To say, for example, we used it during the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. When Russia was saying that they weren't moving troops to the border, we were obtaining satellite imagery that was actually showing massive troops moving towards the border. So it's really great for being able to say, no, this is actually what's going on.
So one question I have is, Susan, why are you doing this, and why isn't, the UN doing this instead?
Well, the UN does do some of this, actually. They have a team called UNOSAT, and they work specifically for UN agencies. But I think it's important that we do this at AAAS. We're an independent scientific nonprofit. And so a lot of the information that we're able to distribute is seen as it's equally scientific, but less biased. And we're coming at it from just a purely scientific and documentation point of view. So I think that people find our analysis to be slightly less controversial than the analysis that comes from different groups that have very specific agendas.
Sarah, when did satellite data become good enough to use in the way that you and Susan use it?
So high-resolution satellite sensors started being available in the late 1990s to early 2000s, but at that time they were incredibly expensive. To get a single high-resolution image of, say, a 5-by-5-kilometer area could be $5,000 to $10,000, whereas now the satellite data costs between $10 and $20 per square kilometer. So while it's not free, it's certainly very much in the realm of affordability for archaeologists and anthropologists and people who are working in humanitarian efforts.
And is this getting better all the time? Is the technology rapidly advancing as far as what you can see and how clear the picture is?
Oh, yes. It's incredible. So I work a lot with a company called Digital Globe. They provide most of the high-resolution satellite data I use, and they just launched a new satellite sensor called WorldView 3. And from hundreds of miles in space, you can zoom in and see things as small as 10 inches. The resolution is 30 centimeters. So I joke with my students, it's almost like we're cheating. You know, we can really from space see anything from a tiny wall to a small feature, and that resolution is only going to be getting better and better as time goes on.
So Susan, tell me how that works, how that helps in your work, that ability to see something so small from so far up.
Well, it's great for us because a lot of the work that we do is in non-permissive environments. We work in a lot of conflict zones. We work in documenting things that are happening in countries where the governments probably don't want to let us come in and investigate. So, for example, we've used satellite imagery to look for mass graves. We look at attacks on civilians, housing demolitions, a whole range of different human rights-related issues. And so the satellites give us an ability to look in on what was happening. And because every time one of these images is collected, it goes into an archive, we have this growing set of imagery that we can look at and, you know, build cases over time and understand what's happening. And so it's really phenomenal. Just over the past 10 years, the amount of imagery and the amount of requests. So my team often takes requests from human rights organizations to help them with documentation. And so now almost every time someone comes to us with a request, we can help them out and we can get satellite imagery to document the things that they're interested in. Where when I first started doing this work, it was really sad that, you know, a lot of times you would have to turn people down because there just wasn't data that was available.
Well, can you tell us more about how you're able to do humanitarian monitoring and track human rights violations?
Sure. A lot of work that my team is doing has recently been focusing on international litigation and prosecutions. So, for example, providing evidence to the European Court of Human Rights or the International Criminal Court, because they're really looking for ways to improve the provision of evidence and to not rely as much on just eyewitness testimony, because there's been instances where eyewitnesses have been disappeared or they've been intimidated into not testifying. So by being able to provide more scientific evidence, they're able to build much stronger cases. So that's one of the really great ways that we're able to improve some human rights documentation with the technology. But we also partner with a lot of small groups that are working all around the world. And you know, we've looked at just tons of different things. We've done oil spills, and just it's amazing the questions that you can answer that you didn't even know you could answer once you start digging in and exploring what the options are.
We're going to take some phone calls here. Zach is calling from Auburn, Alabama. Hi, Zach. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question for Dr. Parkak. I was recently speaking with one of her colleagues, except this person is at the University of Alabama in Huntsville as opposed to Birmingham. And he mentioned that he was one time looking for ruins out in the middle of Guatemala for the Mayans, and he stumbled across a pipeline. So I was wondering, what's the most random thing that she has stumbled across while looking for ruins?
That's a great question. I'm sure. I think you were probably talking to my colleague and friend, Dr. Tom Seaver, who I call him the father of space archaeology. He's one of the real pioneers of using this for archaeology. You know, this really shows you how important it is to go out in the field. We call it ground truthing. You think you're seeing something from space, and sometimes it's obvious. It's a certain rectilinear form, and it's a certain size and shape and orientation, and it's near other things like tombs, so you can be pretty sure it's a tomb. In other cases, you really can't be sure, so you've got to go out in the field and excavate, which, of course, is the fun part. I've been surprised in the field. You know, sometimes you think something is a site, and it isn't. Other times, you go into the field, and the satellites didn't show anything, and you get redirected. So this process of work on the ground can actually help you to focus your imagery better. Sometimes I find things that I didn't think I would find. So quick example, I was doing survey work in Middle Egypt a couple of years ago, and I thought what I would find would be sites that dated to 3,300 years ago. The sites were much more recent than that. So this is why you have to go out on the ground and really check and confirm what you're seeing.
You're developing a platform to enable anyone to search for cultural treasures via satellite maps. How do people do this? I mean, going on Google Maps, but you just need to know what to look for. Tell us more about the project.
It's like Google Maps in that people are going to see imagery, but with this platform, I'm partnering with a Digital Globe and National Geographic, and what we're doing with my team is we're batch processing huge amounts of satellite data. We don't know yet what country we'll start in, but what we'll do is by processing this satellite data in different parts of the light spectrum, we'll put that data up on this platform. Of course, users will register, they'll be trained, and they'll then get to compare these different satellite images just like we do in the lab. They'll be doing good science and seeing if they can see anything. Do they see site looting? Do they see any potential archaeological features? And there'll be little examples off to the side showing them other known features as well. And I just want to say there will not be any mapping data or GPS data connected to the images they're seeing because, of course, we have to protect the sites.
I'm John Dankosky. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And I think that's a really important piece of this whole conversation, Susan, is protecting the sites, right? You want to be able to open this up to as many people as possible, and you want to have people help you find things. But at the same point, you don't want to point criminals or looters or anyone who might do harm to something to the places where things are. How do you balance these two things, Susan?
Yeah, that's a really great question and something I actually feel very, very strongly about. As a person who works in human rights and conflict zones, we're really concerned because of the fact that we can actually obtain these very high-resolution satellite images within an hour or two of them being collected. So if you're looking at a place, for example, where maybe ISIS has blown up a monument, the people are still located in that, likely still in the nearby area. And if there's this rush to, you know, publish these images and all of this, I think that it, you know, you have the potential that you could put people in danger. And you know, when we're talking about humanitarian response, the main thing is first do no harm. So if you don't know for sure that the release of this satellite imagery is going to, you know, that nobody is going to be harmed from it, you don't do it. And so we are very conservative in the information that we publish, and we've been calling on colleagues across all the different sciences and news media to also, you know, when they hear about the destruction of an ancient site or something like that, to take a minute to think about, you know, what will happen. And we don't want to just feed into the propaganda because, you know, that's what, you know, ISIS, for example, wants us to do. They want us to get upset that, you know, a tomb has been destroyed and they, you know, they want that news media attention. So we don't want to give them exactly what they want.
Yeah, and Sarah, even if it's not someone like ISIS or ISIL wanting to do damage because of what somebody sees, I mean, I'm sure that you deal in situations where you don't want to point to very sensitive archaeological sites because you might just have people showing up. They're trying to do their own digging.
That's right. You know, I actually I get requests. It's almost every day now from people who send me snapshots of sites they think they found on Google Earth. And a lot of times it's from slightly sketchy Yahoo accounts, and they're being sent to me from somewhere in the Middle East. And I mean, a lot of times people find sites, but of course I never respond. I keep a folder with that information. People are using Google Earth to find things. And if you know what you're looking for, even visually, these things can be easy to find. So this is why what Susan said, you know, resonates so deeply, and we just have to be so careful and make sure, especially when we're publishing, we're not revealing site location data. But the reality is we're falling far, far behind the looters right now. And if we don't use these new technologies and get the world involved with helping to map looting so that we can help government authorities, we're going to lose this battle.
Sarah Parkak is a National Geographic Fellow and Professor of Anthropology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. She stars in a new PBS special from Nova and the BBC called Vikings Unearthed. You can check it out at pbs.org/Nova. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks also to Susan Wolfenbarger, who's Director of the Geospatial Technologies Project at AAAS in Washington, D.C. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, we're going to uncover the secret lives of plants and the scientists who study them. We'll talk with geobiologist Hope Jaron about her new book called Lab Girl. Hope you can join us. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Have you ever considered the life of a plant? If you think about it, from the plant's point of view, you'd realize it is filled with all kinds of drama. All the unknowns that unfold while it tries to establish itself from the ground up, the struggle for resources in an overcrowded and hostile landscape, and the balance of relationships it needs to maintain between unsympathetic competitors and loyal allies. My next guest has thought a lot about this. She found it can be pretty similar to the life of a scientist. In her new book, Lab Girl, she uncovers the secret life of plants. She also writes about the personal side of being a scientist that we don't usually hear about, from dumpster diving for lab equipment to her Bonnie and Clyde relationship with her lab partner, Bill. Hope Jaron is the author of Lab Girl. She's also a geobiologist at the University of Hawaii at Manoa in Honolulu. Welcome to the show, Hope.
Thank you.
You can read an excerpt from this book on our website, sciencefriday.com/labgirl. If you've got a question for Hope Jaron about life in the lab, give us a call, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK, or you can tweet us at SciFry. You said that you know scientists who study birds, and that's great and all, but it's just not interesting to you. But you are really, really interested in leaves and plants. What got you so interested?
It's not fair to say that I'm totally uninterested. It's that I very much respect people who study other organisms, with the exception of one organism, the tardigrade, which I make a great show of being vehemently opposed to on Twitter, just because I think it's funny. People fight about all kinds of stuff on Twitter, so why shouldn't I be on there being unreasonable about tardigrades? But anyway, what I meant to illustrate by that is that I don't have that particular draw toward birds. I know people that will go out and sit in the rain for days and go around the world to dangerous places in the hopes of just crossing paths with this bird. And I don't get that. But then again, I'll go halfway around the world to see a place where a tree used to be. I've worked in the Arctic for years, and there's certainly no trees up there now, but you uncover the rocks, you dig down a little bit, and good grief, there used to be forests up there. And I can get close to those leaves. They've been waiting for me for 45 million years, it seems, when I'm up there. And so it's hard to put into words that draw that comes from deep, deep inside, but I believe that a lot of scientists have that toward their study organism or toward their study model or toward their system or machine or whatever it is that we're drawn to these things in a way that makes us gladly pay the price of long hours and isolation and all these kinds of things. And that's the story I really wanted to tell.
Mm. When did you start to realize that you had this deep connection to the natural world and also to the world of science?
Well, that's an important story for me, is that my father was a community college instructor. He instructed just hundreds of students. He instructed students, and then he instructed their kids, and he instructed my teachers. It was a rural area in southern Minnesota. And he was a physics teacher. Physics was this great love. And he taught for 42 consecutive years at a community college. And he ran a lab, right? He had a teaching lab where he had the demonstrations and students could do stuff. And we were his kids. And so we were always around the lab waiting for him to get done or grade or my family was always working. So, you know, after dinner, you did some work. And we went into the lab with him and did stuff until it was time to go to bed. And so as a very little girl, my earliest memories are being in the lab and the way the cement felt and the way it smelled and the way the countertops looked and it just being this wonderful, warm, happy place where it was just full of toys, but they weren't really toys. They were serious. And I could do anything I wanted with them because my father's endlessly patient in terms of letting us, you know, take it all out and do whatever we wanted and fix it, but also treated us like we were important. You know, we were his colleagues and we were helping him do this stuff. And it was something that I couldn't imagine not having in my life. I remember being tiny and thinking, when I grow up, my lab is going to have this and we're going to do it this way. And that always stayed with me. And I think that's what's held me in science all these years.
It's
not the formal education I received, but going back to those very early days.
Going back to those early days and just the love of being around the lab and in that world, it's so interesting, different people's perceptions. You know, my mom worked in a lab in a hospital, and all I remember was feeling like I was going to break something. There were these harsh overhead fluorescent lights. It felt to me unwelcoming, but you write about the lab as a sanctuary, a place of warmth.
Well, I did break things. The lights were harsh, but it's not about breaking things. It's about fixing things. And there isn't anything in the world that can't be fixed by some combination of love and work. I do believe that, and I've seen it in my own life. And I'm so fortunate I get the chance to say it. It's a whole book, and that's really all it says.
The book is Lab Girl by Hope Jaron, who joins us in the program today. If you want to join us, 844-724-8255. She writes about her life in the lab and also about her work with plants. You study the carbon isotope composition of terrestrial land plants. So what does that mean? And tell us why this is important.
I know. It's funny. You know, you say that and you realize that it's this code. You know, that's the best way to describe what I do. And that's the way I describe it on reports. And that's what I'm paid to do. But it's a string of words that the vast majority of people couldn't understand. That's funny. You know, think about that for a minute. But here's what it really means. It means that I'm interested in life on land. I'm interested in how the bare bones of the planet, things that aren't alive, are transformed into things that are alive. So, and the very, very front end of that. So we've got the atmosphere, we've got sunlight, we've got water. These are things you can point to and say they're not alive. And the very, very first transformations are done by plants. They turn it into sugar is the very first step. They take energy from the sun and carbon from the atmosphere and bang, you've got a sugar. And plants, I'm using loosely there because there's plants in the ocean and there's plants on land. And my specialty is the plants on land, which include all the great plants, as I like to say, the trees that live for hundreds of years and weigh several tons. And the plants that are so dependent on water, but gosh, they climbed up on land to the place where there wasn't any and somehow made a go of it. And it's like this impossible problem that they solved, and they solved it really well. And I love it.
I'm going to ask you to read a part of your book where you describe the life of a vine. Could you do this for us?
Yes. A vine makes it up as it goes along. The copious vine seeds that rain down from the top of the forest sprout easily, but only rarely take root. Green and malleable, they search frantically for something to cling to, some scaffolding that will provide the strength that they so completely lack. Vines resolve to fight their way up to the light by any means necessary. They do not play by the rules of the forest. They place their roots in one optimal spot and grow their leaves elsewhere, a different optimum, usually several trees over. They are the only plant on land that grows farther sideways than it does up. Vines steal. They steal patches of light left unattended and rivulets of rain. Vines do not enter into apologetic symbiosis, but instead grow bigger at every opportunity, a dead scaffold being just as good as a living one.
So many of your descriptions of plant life and process in the book is just beautiful. I guess I'm wondering if you can talk about that in contrast to the somewhat sterile things you have to write in your day job. I mean, the scientific papers have a very different tone and feel, and they can be impenetrable to people. I guess I'm wondering why in science there has to be this difference, right? That way of describing a vine is something that we can all relate to, but the way that you might have to describe it in your scientific paper is something that many people would never be able to grasp.
Yeah, and that's been an interesting thing that I've had the opportunity to think very deeply about. I have a lot of ideas about how that sanitizing process is meant to protect science, to protect its elite status as not something everyone can do. And how better to do that than to talk about it in a way that not everybody can understand. And so with this book, I've decided to break all of those rules. I mean, by saying that a plant chooses where to grow, I've broken a rule. I'm supposed to say that a plant establishes itself under optimum resources or something like that. But by doing that, I've done a couple of things. I've taken it out of the realm of your everyday words, and I've also adopted a tone that's meant to detach you from the intuitive experiences that you have that you might relate or sympathize to what I'm saying. And so I've decided to break all those rules. I don't know what the punishment will be, but I've surely done it. The other thing that I'd like to say is that writing is a gift. It's a gift, and it's up to the recipient to decide if it's a good gift or not. And we've all gotten gifts that are like, you know somebody who's a great tennis player, and you're not an athlete, but they give you a tennis racket for Christmas, and you kind of feel like, well, you know, I'm supposed to go learn to play tennis, and na-na-na-na-na. And I think a lot of science writing is like that. It's some great tennis player giving you a tennis racket, whether you want it or not. This is more like me wondering about you, crafting something that I hope you'll like, wrapping it up, handing it over, and waiting to see. And right now, the book just came out. I'm waiting to see. And it's a really special time for me.
Yeah, I wonder if some scientists worry about the risk of anthropomorphizing, about saying that the vine or the tree is making its own choices. It's telling an imprecise story about how the tree actually works and makes decisions.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, when scientists read this book, the big comment that I get is that I wrote in there, and I don't know the exact sentence off the top of my head, but I wrote, plants are the only organisms that can turn inorganic matter into sugar. And I get incredibly upset, you know, responses from scientists over that. You'd think I was inciting people to violence by writing that sentence. It's really amazing. And they say, you don't mean plants, you mean autotrophs, and you are not necessarily incorporating unicellular autotrophs into that description, et cetera. And what I've done there, and trust me, I thought a lot. I thought about every sentence in this book, and I was absolutely pigheaded about keeping terminology out of it to the biggest extent possible. I gave myself a structure, and I said, I'm not going to violate that structure by introducing scientific terms. And so if I sacrificed some of the precision associated by saying plants, mm-hmm. when what I really mean is multicellular and unicellular, eukaryotic and prokaryotic autotrophs, then that's price we're just going to have to pay to talk to a new group of people.
I'm sure that our listeners will forgive you. I'm John Dankosky. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And we're talking with Hope Jaron about her new book, Lab Girl. When we hear about a scientist who has their own lab, it sounds like you've reached a goal, but you really show that labs are always scrambling for funding. Can you talk about the problem of finding funding to do the work you love?
It's painful. And I've been funded, and I'm very grateful for the funding. It's never enough. I'm very sensitive to the fact that this comes from tax dollars, from people who work long hours and don't love their jobs. And the only way I can be grateful for that is to assure them that I stretch every nickel into a quarter. And so we've always been able to survive basically by promising that we'll do $5 worth of work for every dollar you give us. But that's not a general solution. If you look at the numbers, there's simply not enough funding out there to support scientists to do the work that they were trained to do. And that's a problem because, you know, if you talk to the public, all these polls say that the public is very supportive of science. They want to see science grow in America, et cetera. And I don't think they realize that we're at the breaking point. Funding for non-defense related research has been flat for 30 years. Every administration. I mean, maybe the parties talk differently about how they support science, but when it comes right down to it, it's been flat. And all this time, we've been educating generation after generation of scientists as best we possibly could, and they want to do science. And there's just there's just too many hyenas at the carcass, is how I put it sometimes.
Well, you grapple with something else that has been part of the conversation around science, is the role of women in the sciences and the pervasive sexism and harassment that you've had to face. Talk about that for just a moment, if you would, because we just have a little bit of time left. But, you know, how you're maybe bringing in a slightly different narrative than the one we've had in the past about women in the sciences.
You know, I get asked about that, but I'm not saying anything shocking or even controversial. I'm saying that the basic power imbalance between men and women that we have learned and we have accepted as part of what glues our society together, and that the violence and harm that is a product of that learned imbalance is also expressed within the confines of science, that we're not free of it, and that it has some special expressions due to the special activities that women find themselves doing, like working alone in labs, like traveling for field trips, etc. And so I've been surprised that I'm getting such a strong reaction for that, because I really don't feel like, of all the things I say, I feel like that's the least controversial thing I've brought up.
Hope Jaron is the author of Lab Girl. She's also a geobiologist at the University of Hawaii at Manoa in Honolulu. Read an excerpt from this book at our website, sciencefriday.com/labgirl, and it is a wonderful memoir. Thank you so much, Hope, for being here. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. You can email us at scifry@sciencefriday.com. On the web this week, we've got a story about a mysterious boiling river in the middle of the Amazon jungle. It must be seen to be believed. Read more about it at sciencefriday.com. Ira is back next week. In New York, I'm John Dankosky.